sharp, brief burst of light. It was the fighters, gunned by the B-29s, blowing up. On the bombers went, imperious. The bird watched, stricken. "Hikoki dami," he said. "Hikoki dami." Japan's planes, he was lamenting, were no good. Every B-29 that crossed over Tokyo wound the bird tighter. He slapped an officer repeatedly for 5 minutes. He pawed through the men's belongings, destroying family photographs. He was seized with paranoia. "You win war," he screamed, "and you make all Japanese like black slaves." He hauled Bob Martindale to his office, accused him of plotting arson, and beat him so wildly that he overturned all his furniture. One night, during a sleet storm, the POWs were jarred awake by the bird charging through camp, ordering a fire drill. When the designated firefighters assembled, the bird punched them, ran through the barracks, shouting and hitting men, ordered all POWs outside, then drew his sword, swung it around, and screamed orders. For 2 hours, as sleet drummed on the shivering men, he forced them to pump water on imaginary fires, beat phantom blazes with brooms, and run through buildings rescuing food and documents. As December progressed and the bombers kept coming, the bird's mania deepened. He marched the officers into Tokyo, leapt on a water trough, drew his sword, and screamed, "Kirei!" As the men saluted, the bird stood in an exaggerated troop-reviewing pose, lost in a fantasy of military glory. After the POWs had passed, he jumped down, ran ahead, and hopped on another trough, shouting, striking his pose, and demanding salutes. Over and over he repeated the farce, driving the men on for miles. When the bombs were falling, the bird would snap, running with sword in the air, wailing, foam flying from his mouth, face purple. During one bombing, he ran the POWs outside, stood them at attention, and ordered the guards to aim rifles at them, while he raced among them, swinging his sword over their heads. No one felt the bird's wrath as did Louis. Every day the bird sped around in search of the American. Louis hid, but the bird always found him, launching himself at him in what Tinker called his death lunge. Dazed and bleeding, Louis was sure Watanabe wouldn't stop until he was dead. Under the onslaught, Louis began to come apart. The bird stalked his dreams, screeching, whipping him with his belt. In the dreams, Louis's rage would overwhelm him, and he'd leap on his monster, his hands on the corporal's neck, strangling the life from him. Some 300 miles away, Phil was wasting away in Zentsuji POW camp. He'd been transferred there in August, joining one-legged Fred Garrett. The Zentsuji diet was so poor that men wandered about, ravenous, pulling up weeds and eating them. Their drinking water was runoff from rice paddies fertilized with human excrement, which left all POWs afflicted with severe diarrhea. In one barracks, men lost an average of 54 pounds over 18 months. Some 20 men fainted each day. Others went blind from malnutrition. In November, they buried an American who'd starved to death. On a Friday night in December 1944, the telephone rang in the house of Phil's mother, Kelsey. The War Department had received news from Zentsuji. Alan was alive. Jubilant, Kelsey asked the department to cable her husband and her son's fiancé. In Washington, Sessie got the news she'd awaited for so long. The fortune teller had said Alan would be found before Christmas. It was December 8th. Sessie shouted with joy, quit her job, dashed through her apartment, throwing clothes and pictures of Alan into a suitcase, and hopped a plane for Indiana to wait for her fiancé to come home. In letters sent to the Zamperinis and Phillipses, the War Department asked family members not to speak publicly about the fact that Louis and Alan were alive. The department probably didn't want it known that it had mistakenly declared two men dead, especially as the Japanese were publicizing this fact in order to demoralize Allied troops. Both families honored this request, and the public went on believing that both Louis and Phil were dead. As relieved as Kelsey was, she couldn't forget that others were so much less fortunate. Of the Green Hornet men, only Louis and Alan had been found. "It is difficult to rejoice outwardly when I think of the other mothers," Kelsey wrote to Louise. "How my heart goes out to them." As Christmas neared, Louis faltered. Starvation was consuming him. The Red Cross sent relief packages, but the Japanese stole them. We could see them throwing away unmistakable wrappers, carrying bowls of bulk cocoa and sugar between huts, and even trying to wash clothes with cakes of American cheese, wrote Tom Wade. Out of 240 relief boxes, the birds stole 48, more than 500 pounds of goods. One day the bird ordered all POWs outside, where they found a truck brimming with apples and oranges. As the famished men grabbed the fruit, photographers snapped photos. Just as the men were ready to eat, the order came to put it all back. The entire thing had been staged for propaganda. On Christmas Eve came a small, sweet respite from the suffering. Among the POWs was a chronically filthy, ingenious kleptomaniac named Mansfield. Shortly before Christmas, Mansfield broke into the storehouse, slipping past 7 guards, and made off with several Red Cross packages, which he buried under his barracks. Discovering his cache, guards locked him in a punishment cell. Mansfield broke out, stole 16 more parcels, and snuck back to the cell. He built a secret compartment and hid the loot inside, marking the door with a message for other imprisoned POWs: "Food, help yourself, lift here." Caught again, he was tied to a tree for days. In conversations with other POWs, Mansfield mentioned that in the storehouse he'd found a Red Cross theatrical trunk. This gave the POWs the idea of staging a Christmas play. They secured the bird's approval by naming him Master of Ceremonies and giving him a throne at the front of the theater, the bathhouse, with planks perched on washtubs to serve as a stage. The men put on a production of Cinderella, written with hilarious creative liberties. Frank Tinker was Prince Leander of Pantoland. The fairy godmother was a gigantic Brit in a tutu and tights. Characters included Lady Diarrhea and Lady Gonorrhea. The guards laughed and clapped, and Louis thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. The bird gloried in the limelight, and for that night he let Louis and the others be. After Christmas, the bird stopped attacking the POWs, even Louis. He paced, brooding. The men watched him and wondered what was going on. They soon learned. He'd been promoted to sergeant and transferred to another camp. Someone told Louis the bird was leaving. Louis was overwhelmed with joy and relief. The bird threw himself a goodbye party. The officers dashed around camp gathering stool samples from dysentery patients, slathered the gravy over rice cakes, and presented them to him as a gift. As the men spoke of how they'd miss him, the bird ate heartily. If the rice cakes performed as intended, they didn't do so quickly. As Louis watched, the bird left looking perfectly well. The reign of terror was over. Chapter 27 Falling Down. At Omori, life became immeasurably better. Humane, fair-minded Japanese took over. The birds' rules were abolished. In the birds' office, they found a pile of old letters sent to POWs by their families, but kept from the prisoners. The letters were distributed. The POWs were allowed to write home. "Trust you're all in good health and in the highest of spirits, not the kind that comes in bottles," Louis wrote in one letter. "Tell Pete," he wrote in another, "that when I'm 50, I'll have more hair on my head than he had at 20. 2 weeks into 1945, a group of battered men trudged into Omori. Louis knew their faces. These were Ofuna men. Among them, Commander Fitzgerald. Louis spotted Bill Harris, and his heart fell. Harris was a wreck. When Louis greeted him, his old friend looked at him vaguely. After Louis had left Ofuna, the quack had twice more clubbed Harris into unconsciousness, once for speaking aloud, and once for stealing nails to repair his tattered shoes. Harris was hazy and distant, his mind struggling. One of the Omori POWs was a physician, and he examined Harris gravely. He told Louis he thought the Marine was dying. That day, the new commander had Red Cross boxes handed out. Louis gave his box to Harris. It was, he said, the hardest and easiest thing he ever did. Harris rallied. The B-29s kept coming. Louis was worried. The guards were increasingly jumpy and angry. As the assaults on Japan intensified and the probability of invasion rose, they seemed to view the POWs as threatening. Among American forces, horrifying news had just surfaced. On Palawan Island in the Philippines, 150 American POWs had long been held as slaves by the Japanese. When an American convoy passed nearby, a Japanese commander was apparently sure the Americans would invade, the scenario for which the kill-all order had been written. He radioed to Palawan, "Annihilate the 150 prisoners." The next day, the Palawan guards suddenly began screaming that the enemy planes were coming. The POWs crawled into air raid shelters and waited, hearing no planes. Then liquid rained onto them. Gasoline. The guards tossed in torches, then hand grenades. The shelters and the men inside erupted in flames. As the guards cheered, the POWs fought to escape, some clawing their fingertips off. Those who broke out were bayoneted, machine-gunned, or beaten to death. Only 11 escaped, swimming across a bay and making it to safety. That night, the Japanese threw a party to celebrate the massacre. The anticipation of an American landing turned out to be mistaken. Sleet was falling over Omori as February 16th dawned. Louis had just finished breakfast when the sirens piped up and the room began shaking. He ran out into a crashing, tumbling world. The entire sky was swarming with hundreds of fighters, American and Japanese, streaming bullets at each other. Over Tokyo, dive bombers bellied down, slamming bombs into the aircraft factories and airport. As they rose, quills of fire came up under them. It was the largest air battle yet fought over Japan, and Louis was directly underneath it. The guards fixed bayonets and forced the POWs inside. Louis and the others waited for the guards to leave, then stole out. They ran behind a building and climbed the camp fence. The view was electrifying. Planes were sweeping over every part of the sky, and all around, fighters were plunging into the water. One dogfight riveted Louis's attention. An American Hellcat fighter hooked up with a Japanese fighter and began chasing it. The Japanese fighter turned toward the city and dove low over the bay, the Hellcat right behind it. The two planes streaked past the camp, the Japanese fighter flat out, the Hellcat's guns firing. Several hundred POWs watched from the camp fence, their faces pressed to knotholes, or their heads poking over the top, hearts leaping, ears roaring. The fighters were so close that Louis could see both pilots' faces. The Japanese fighter crossed over the coast, and the Hellcat broke away. All told, 1,500 American planes and several hundred Japanese planes flew over the POWs that day. That night, Tokyo was bathed in fire. The following day, back the planes came. By the end of February 17th, more than 500 Japanese planes on the ground and in the air had been lost, and Japan's aircraft works were badly hit. The Americans lost 80 planes. 7 days later, the hammer fell. At 7 a.m., during a heavy snowstorm, 1,600 carrier-based planes screamed past Omori and bombed Tokyo. Then came B-29s, 229 of them, carrying firebombs. Encountering almost no resistance, they sped for the industrial district and let their bombs fall. The POWs saw fire dancing over the skyline. 26 million square feet of the city was burning. On the last day of February, 15 POW officers were called out, among them Zamperini, Wade, Tinker, and Fitzgerald. They were told they were being transferred to a camp called Naoetsu. Perhaps this was the promised punishment camp, but Louis greeted the news with bright spirits. Whatever Naoetsu was, he'd be with almost all of his friends. The following evening, the chosen men gathered their belongings. Louis said goodbye to Harris, then climbed aboard a truck with the other men and rode into Tokyo. They were shocked at the sight. Whole neighborhoods had been reduced to charred ruins, row after row of homes, now nothing but black bones. Transferred to a train, the POWs rode all night, moving west into a snowy landscape. In early morning, the train drew up to Naoetsu, a seaside village in western Japan. The POWs stared in amazement. The snow rose some 14 feet around the station. Climbing a stairway cut in the drifts, they found themselves in a blinding white world, standing atop a snow mountain that buried the entire village. It was so deep that residents had dug vertical tunnels to get out of their homes. Pulling their baggage on sleighs, the POWs began the long walk to camp. It was windy and bitterly cold. Fitzgerald, who had a badly infected foot, struggled. His crutches poked deep in the snow and wouldn't hold his weight. The prisoners crossed a bridge and saw the Sea of Japan. Just short of it, cornered against two rivers, was Naoetsu POW camp, almost entirely obscured by snow. Louis and the others trudged in and stopped before a shack, where they were told to stand at attention. They waited, the wind frisking their clothes. A door thumped open. A man rushed out and snapped to a halt, screaming, "Kirei!" It was the bird. Louis' legs folded, the snow reared up at him, and down he went. Chapter 28. Enslaved. It was the darkest moment of Louis' life. The bird stood over him, triumphant. "I am in command," he said. "You will obey." Commander Fitzgerald forked forward on his crutches and assumed the duties of senior POW. Ringing with shock, Louis picked himself up and hiked to the barracks, a tumble-down warehouse on the edge of a cliff over the Okura River. Wind whistled through the walls, snow fell through the holes in the roof, and rats trotted along the baseboards. The beds were planks. The bedding was loose straw. To survive sub-zero temperatures, the POWs had pried up and burned the floorboards, leaving gaping holes. The 300 residents, mostly Australians,